And now for our weekly wrap-up of global politics with Dr. Stephen Hoadley, Associate Professor of Politics and International Relations at the University of Auckland's Faculty of Arts. Good morning, Dr. Stephen. And this morning, why don't we begin with the situation in Afghanistan? What's the political problem taking place there currently?
Good morning, Brian. We'll start with some bad news, but I hope we'll end our conversation with some better news this morning. Afghanistan is a troubled country. It's a 40 million people riven by mountains and valleys, by ethnic divisions. There are four major ethnic groups there, by tribal leaders, by warlords, by militia, and of course the problems not only in Kabul, but with the Taliban. Now, let's go to Kabul is the capital, and there they have had elections sponsored by Western countries. They're trying to work out some sort of guided democracy system, but the current president is being challenged by another challenger president. So even in Kabul, they can't get their act together. They've got two presidents, two factions vying, and this makes it impossible for the Kabul government to stand firm and to resist the encroachments of the Taliban, which is a radical fundamentalist Muslim movement backed by fighters that have been fighting for 20 or 30 years, first against the Soviet Union successfully, and then against the United States and its allies. And consequently, the health system is poor. The coronavirus pandemic is coming to Afghanistan. The people are impoverished. The education system is spotty. So I guess the major message here is sympathy for the Afghans, long-suffering, and we hope that somehow they can get their political system stabilized so they can improve the social and economic conditions of the population.
Is this a problem for the United States currently, and taking into account of the big war that they're having with COVID-19 currently, Dr. Stephen?
Well, it's an opportunity for President Trump to deflect blame, to claim victory. He negotiated an agreement with the Taliban challengers a few months ago, in which he essentially gave in to the Taliban all of their demands and pledged that the United States would pull out its troops. It's had up to 120,000 troops there. It's lost 2,000 casualties. It spent $1 trillion in Afghanistan with no effect. The Taliban are still as strong as they ever were. And Trump is determined to pull out. This then means that the government of Afghanistan, the Kabul government, is going to stand alone without the support of the United States against this radical movement, radical Muslim movement, and the future doesn't look very bright. But for Donald Trump, it's a victory. It's a victory in his personal effort to regain the presidency in the coming election. I think it's a fraud. Most governments think it's a fraud. It's a pullout. It's a cop-out by the United States at a crucial time in Afghan history.
Why does the situation matter to us here in this part of the world, Dr. Stephen?
Well, first of all, a number of Afghan refugees have made their way to New Zealand. So we have an small Afghan population here. They're very concerned about what's happening back home or back in their previous homes. There's a humanitarian question because the Taliban are brutal. They suppress women. Girls will not be able to go to school under the Taliban rule, judging by the way they ruled Afghanistan a decade ago. They use torture. They cut off ears and noses of those who they believe are taking the wrong path. They require all men to wear beards, highly intrusive, highly authoritarian. So from a humanitarian point of view, we would not like this particular brand of Islam to spread and to take over in an entire country of 40 million people. It would be a step backwards to civil liberties, human rights, and common decency.
Now, to the rivalry between the United States and China, maybe taking a new turn. What's the latest update there?
Well, Donald Trump has signed an executive order allowing U.S. companies to mine in space, that is, to go up to the moon or to Mars and dig up whatever they can find there to exploit the resources, the minerals of the various planets and asteroids of our solar system. This is part of America's geostrategic policy. It also indicates that the Trump administration is not going to go and work through international law or international organizations. It's going to go on its own. So it's another illustration of what many people, at least speaking for myself, don't like about the Trump administration, its lack of cooperation internationally. Now, the Chinese are not going to sit by idly. They have a space program of their own. One of the advantages for the United States is if they can mine some of the rare earth metals from the planets, it would break the monopoly that China now has on them. These rare earth metals are components in the cell phone that I'm using right now and other electronic devices. So the United States would increase the supply. That might be a good thing, to have a bit of competition so the Chinese don't monopolize the market. But we're talking long term. We're talking decades from now. So one can foresee the United States and China, that has landed a space probe on the backside of the moon already, engaged in a new space race, which we'll no doubt be talking about in future in these conversations, Brian.
And speaking of China, Winston Peters' recent comments in support of Taiwan's participation in the World Health Organization, why could it be interpreted as controversial?
Well, it's controversial because the Chinese don't like it. This is the Chinese in Beijing. There is, of course, a Chinese government in Taipei, which preceded the Beijing government by 50 years, the Republic of China and Taiwan. Have a very good health system. They've had very few deaths, very few COVID infections. They've probably set the pace along with South Korea and Iceland as doing the best job, along with New Zealand, of course, in the top five, of curbing this pandemic. And they simply want to become a member of the World Health Organization so they can work with that group, so they can share their information and work cooperatively with every other government in the world against the common enemy, which is disease, infection, and other health problems. Well, the government in Beijing says an emphatic no. Taiwan is a province of China. The One China policy dictates that Taiwan must be subordinate to China, and therefore it cannot be a co-equal member of the World Health Organization. Well, what Winston Peters is proposing is really quite mild. He just says he wants the Taiwan, under whatever name it might be called Chinese Taipei, which is the formula for the Olympics, or the World Trade Organization, for example, to be an observer, not a full member. So the Chinese should be able to accept that. But no, they have responded very strongly. They've hinted that there might be economic repercussions. The relationship would be shaken if New Zealand persists in this goal. And Winston Peters has reassured us most recently on television last night that he's got assurances from the ambassador, Madam Wu, that New Zealand will not be punished for this particular view. So New Zealand does have a One China policy. It does respect the sovereignty of the government in Beijing. All it wants is that this very important country of 24 million people that has a sterling record in health provision simply be able to share its knowledge and work cooperatively with other governments against the common enemy.
Moving to the Pacific now, a new referendum on independence for Tokelau, which some people might consider controversial. Tell us more, please.
Well, New Zealand has administered Tokelau since 1925 as a dependent territory, and there have been previous referenda conducted in Tokelau that have reaffirmed the current arrangements whereby New Zealand provides economic assistance and administrative assistance, but the Tokelauans run their own affairs through three atoll councils. that make their local regulations and manage local lives. So it's a comfortable arrangement, but there are some people who believe that at the 100th anniversary of the accession of Tokelau to New Zealand administration, there should be another referendum. And this is being led by the Faipule, Mr. Kalolo, Chief Kalolo, who is the leader of one of the three atolls, one of the three principal councils that manage Tokelauan affairs, and he wants to have a referendum. Well, it will be controversial in Tokelau because the Tokelauans are divided. Not only are they divided within Tokelau, because the vote last time was sort of almost 50-50. It was slightly in favor of staying with New Zealand. But also, there are more Tokelauans living in New Zealand and probably in Auckland, probably within a 20 or 30-mile radius of where we are, Brian. And they'd like to have a voice as well. And they're wondering if this Chief Kalolo is really representing them, because they're numerous, they're doing well, they would like to have a voice in the future of Tokelau. So again, it will be controversial. So the referendum options apparently are, first of all, the question of whether Tokelau should become an independent country, should it have a free association with New Zealand, pretty much like Cook Islands and Niue, which has a similar population, by the way, of about 1,500 people, or should it remain a territory of New Zealand? So we'll watch and see how this unfolds, but we would not deny the right of the Tokelauans to determine their own future. A spokesperson in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs has said they would support this, the conduct, not the outcome, but they support the conduct of the referendum. And the statement by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs is any decision on if and when there would be a referendum on independence is for Tokelau to determine. So the government is doing the right thing. It's up to the Tokelauans. But the question is, which Tokelauans? The Tokelauans who live in Tokelau, or the entire Tokelauan community, including the diaspora, in New Zealand. So we'll probably be talking about this again, Brian.
No doubt. And finally, Dr. Stephen, pleasing news, Pacific news coming out of New Zealand Parliament.
Yes, I promise some good news at the end of our conversation, and that is that Trevor Mallard, the Speaker of the Parliament, is becoming very Pacific conscious. He has set up an organization or a program called Taiakiwa, which has been running for about a year. They've had conversations already with their counterparts in Fiji. He wants to have closer relationships between the New Zealand Parliament and the Parliament or legislatures of the Pacific Island states. And he wants to have delegations. He's got in mind Vanuatu and the Solomons. He's got in mind Cook Islands and maybe one of the French Polynesian states. So he's very much sort of leading his fellow parliamentarians to think more about how New Zealand can assist. Already there's a good example of how the New Zealand Parliament, using some of its specialists in the staff, to assist the Tongan government in tidying and in drafting their budget, which is a very complex procedure, and I think New Zealand has been a little bit of assistance there. That's the kind of thing that Mallard has in mind. So this is all a good sign. He's going to raise the profile of Pacifica, certainly among parliamentarians and indirectly amongst the New Zealand population generally. This must be a good thing, Brian.
A very big thank you, Dr. Stephen Hoadley, Associate Professor of Politics and International Relations at the University of Auckland's Faculty of Arts. Always appreciate your time, Dr. Stephen. We'll look forward to your company again next week, and enjoy the rest of the week. Stay safe. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
It is 11 minutes to 8, 5:31 PI Pacific. People together. It is 11 minutes to 8, 5:31 PI Pacific. People together.